Lecture 8, Socrates.
In the last lecture, I suggested to you that Protagoras, the first and the greatest of the Greek sophists, was the first humanist in the West. He inverted, as I suggested, the pre-Socratic hierarchy in which being is primary, reality is primary. For Protagoras, by contrast, human being is the measure of all things, of things that are that they are, of things that are not that they are not. In saying this, he quite literally puts human being at the center stage. And for this, he deserves, to say the least, enormous credit. He is pushing the conversation of the West forward and demanding that human beings be the center of attention. Nonetheless, we have to acknowledge that Protagoras was not a philosopher. He certainly was a thinker, perhaps even a great thinker, but he was a sophist. He was a believer in relativism, we discussed that issue, and a practitioner and perhaps a teacher of rhetoric. He didn't share with the pre-Socratics this enormous drive that the pre-Socratics seemed to exhibit towards knowledge. The thinker we shall meet in this lecture, Socrates, in a certain sense combines features of both the pre-Socratics and Protagoras. Like Protagoras, as I will show in this lecture, he is committed to thinking about issues that primarily concern human beings. But unlike Protagoras, and much more like the pre-Socratics, he is surely a philosopher. He is committed first and foremost to the project of knowledge. Socrates was an Athenian. He was born and he died in Athens. If you recall, I mentioned in the previous lecture that in the 5th century, there were many sophists. They were itinerant teachers. They tended to come to Athens. Athens was a democracy which valued free speech, which guaranteed free speech. Athens was a great marketplace of ideas. It was ideally suited for people like the sophists. Indeed, the history of Greek philosophy now will be exclusively focused on Athens. Socrates is the first Athenian-born philosopher. After Socrates, really, philosophy takes place in Athens. Socrates was the son of a stonemason and a midwife. He came from rather humble origins. He was notoriously ugly. He had a very big nose and a protruding forehead. He was very thick. He was famous for being very strong, very tough. He was also famous for being very casual in his dress. He didn't wear shoes. He apparently rarely took a bath. He was quite a character, and he made quite an impression on the citizens of Athens. In fact, we know very, very little about Socrates. He lived from 469 to 399, and he was executed by the city of Athens. That certainly is the most remarkable fact in his biography, and it's one which I will discuss in some length in the course of this lecture. Socrates wrote nothing, but fortunately, others wrote about him. The Greek thinker Xenophon, who lived from 428 to 354, wrote several works about Socrates, including one called the Memorabilia, which, as the title suggests, are his memories of Socrates. The great comic playwright Aristophanes wrote a play called The Clouds, which was produced in 420, and that was a brutal lampooning of Socrates. Aristotle, the 4th century Greek philosopher, made several important comments about Socrates, one of which I will turn to in a short while. Finally, however, it's Plato, who wrote 25-some dialogues, who immortalized Socrates. In these dialogues, Socrates very frequently is the hero, is the main speaker. In the next lecture, when I discuss Plato, I'll discuss and elaborate in some detail the relationship between Plato and Socrates. This particular lecture is concentrating almost exclusively on the historical Socrates, the actual man who lived 469 to 399. I do, however, in this lecture, want to draw on one description of Socrates that we find in Plato. And this particular passage that I'm about to discuss concerns a feature of Socrates that I've already mentioned, the fact that he did not write. In Plato's dialogue, the Phaedrus, Socrates, more accurately the character Socrates who is appearing in this dialogue, explains why he did not write. Once again, I don't want now to go into the issue of whether what Plato says about Socrates or what Plato has Socrates say is historically accurate. Nonetheless, I'm still going to draw on this particular passage because I think we'll get an insight even into the historical Socrates. In the Phaedrus, Socrates tells a story. He's very commonly does this in Plato's dialogues. And this story is meant to explain why he does not write. He tells the story of the invention of writing. When writing was first invented, it was counted as a marvelous new technology. The inventor of writing boasted that writing would greatly improve the human intellect. More specifically, what writing would give to humanity as a new form of technology is the greatly enhanced power of memory. No longer would we be reliant simply on our memories alone. With the invention of writing, says the inventor of writing, we will be able to, quite obviously, write things down and then refer to what we've written later, and therefore, we will be smarter. We will be much more adept at information storage and information retrieval. This, once again, is in the story Socrates is telling, the great boast of writing. Socrates himself, however, disputes this story. He disagrees with the inventor of writing. He counters the boast of writing with this. He says, far from improving our memory, in fact, what writing will do is weaken our memory. Writing is an external device. It's a symbolic device. If we write down what we want to remember, we simply aren't required to remember it for ourselves. So what seems to enhance our power to store and then retrieve information, in fact, will weaken it. So exactly the opposite occurs, the opposite of what the inventor of writing boasted writing would accomplish. The inventor of writing believed we would be smarter by using his invention. In fact, however, says Socrates, we get dumber. We become more dependent on the external, less reliant on ourselves. And as a result, our intellects weaken. Socrates has some other criticisms of writing, and they're much in keeping with what I've just said. Specifically, this notion of writing as an external device. When I write something, the written work is outside of me. I am no longer present to protect it. This is the sort of metaphor Socrates uses. The written work circulates in the world. And as such, what happens is that the written work cannot discriminate among its readers. Something written is fixed. A written work, says Socrates, says the same thing to everybody. If a 15-year-old picks up a book, the written work will say exactly what it always says to the 15-year-old. If a 50-year-old picks up the book, the written work always says the same thing. In that sense, writing is indiscriminate. can make this same point. Socrates makes this same point in a slightly different way. A written work is always and necessarily subject to misinterpretation. If I write down my thoughts about Greek philosophy and then I hand them to you and you take them off and you read them in the privacy of your home, you may simply misunderstand, misinterpret what I have written. This is an intrinsic feature of writing. Because the author is not present to explain what he or she means when he or she is writing, the written work is always subject to this misinterpretation. The basic notion in all of these comments is the same. The author is absent. Socrates uses the metaphor of a parent and a child. The written work is very much like a child, but a written work is really like an orphan. It is no longer connected to its parent. Well, perhaps you can see where this line of thought is going. Socrates, in distinction to writing, much prefers face-to-face conversation, what he calls living speech. For him, writing is a kind of dead speech. In a face-to-face conversation, says Socrates, we can exactly overcome the limitations of writing. If I'm speaking to you, I can discriminate. In other words, if I'm speaking to you and you're 15 years old, I might speak in a certain way. I might use certain examples to explain what I mean that I think a 15-year-old would find particularly illuminating. If I'm speaking to a 50-year-old, I might shift my gears a little bit and speak quite differently to the 50-year-old. This is precisely the possibility that living conversation allows and writing, according to Socrates, does not allow. Let me use a word that I used in the very first lecture of this series. The word in Greek is dialegesthai, and it can be translated as to have a conversation or to have a dialogue. And that really is what Socrates is talking about. What he prefers far beyond writing is dialogue, is dialegesthai. Perhaps we might even say he is the inventor of dialogue. What he wants to do is talk to individuals. He wants to look them in the eye, and he wants to communicate specifically with them. Once again, this is a description we find in Plato's dialogue, the Phaedrus. I think, however, it might well apply to the historical Socrates. The historical Socrates, from all of our sources, we seem to think, was a man who wandered around the city. Specifically, he wandered around in what in ancient Athens was known as the agora, the marketplace, the town center, where there were lots of people on the streets. He wandered around and he invited people into dialogue, into conversation. He was, as I mentioned earlier, a rather odd-looking man, a very ugly man, actually, who didn't wear shoes. He wandered around. He seemed not to have a regular job. He simply talked to people. He was indeed quite a strange figure. But what did he talk about? Here I would turn to a line from Aristotle, who says the following: in the time of Socrates, investigation into nature stopped, and philosophers turned away to studying the virtue that is relevant to the conduct of life. I think you can hear in that quotation something familiar. Socrates, on the basis of what I've just read, sounds once again a bit like Protagoras. He turned away from nature and towards something that concerns human life. He turned, Aristotle says, towards virtue. The Greek word is arete, can also be translated as excellence. Socrates turned towards the question, what is an excellent life? How should a human being live? So once again, I think you can feel some similarity with Protagoras, the emphasis on human questions, but even in what I just read, I hope you start to see an important difference. Socrates doesn't sound like a relativist if, in fact, his basic concern is with excellence. What is an excellent life? The very question is one which I can't imagine Protagoras asking. Protagoras is concerned with, first and foremost, rhetoric, the art of persuasion. Socrates, by contrast, is interested in virtue, in excellence, in arete. Let me be a bit more specific about the sorts of questions that Socrates would ask. Once again, I'm drawing largely on Aristotle for this information. Socrates was famous for asking a question which simply read, "What is it?" He's famous for the "what is it" question. In other words, he was seeking definitions. He would ask for definitions specifically of virtues. As we just mentioned, he is primarily concerned with human virtue. So he would ask, "What is virtue? What is courage? What is justice? What is moderation?" These are some of the famous Socratic questions. I think it's important to reflect a little bit on these questions. They're seemingly innocuous, seemingly very familiar, ordinary questions. What is it? What is virtue? I think, however, if you think about it a little bit more, you'll see that these questions are far from innocuous. It's a very strange feature of questions in general. Every time we ask a question, we automatically assume an answer. Let me give an example. What if I were to ask you, who won the game last night? I don't know the answer to that question. However, in asking the question, simply in asking it, I've implied an answer to a different question. The question that has been answered is, what happened last night? Well, there was a game. Simply by asking you who won the game, I'm assuming there was a game. I'm assuming the game had a winner. I'm assuming also that you might well be able to answer this question. The question, in other words, must have an answer. All of those assumptions are packed into the very act of asking the question. If we use that sort of analysis and apply it to Socrates' questions about virtue, I think we'll find some very dramatic consequences. When Socrates asks, what is justice, for example, he seems to be assuming, naturally, that the question can be answered. But if the question can be answered, what he seems to be assuming that there is a single, what he will later call a form of justice. In other words, if I ask what is justice, I'm seeking a definition of justice. If there is a definition of justice, it would cover all the particular instances of justice. So we might have a just city, or we might have a just law, we might have a just individual. If simply by asking the question, what is justice, Socrates seems to be assuming that all these particular instances of justice can be unified, and if I was able to give an answer to the question, I would give an answer which would cover all of the particulars. In other words, simply by asking the question, what is justice, Socrates seems to imply that there is a universal justice, a justice which, when defined, would be able to explain all the particular instances of justice. In other words, what I'm suggesting, and I'm still in the spirit of trying to both compare Socrates to Protagoras, but also show in what way he was fundamentally different, the what is it question seems to be an anti-relativistic question. It seems to imply the possibility of an objective standard, of a universal answer, of even an absolute answer. If that's the case, then clearly simply asking the question is an assault, is an attack on the sophists, on Protagoras. Simply put, Socrates is no relativist. Socrates is asking a kind of question that Protagoras would not dream of asking. It's very important to note, I think, that Socrates himself in no way came up with answers to these questions. However, as I've just suggested, this doesn't mean that he accomplished nothing. In fact, by asking the question, he, as I've said a few times now, has assumed a great deal simply by asking the questions. In fact, he is arguing against the sophists. So now I think you can put this together into a picture of Socrates that's a bit more complete. We have this strange-looking, strange-sounding man wandering around the agora of Athens asking what in fact is a very strange question. Questions like, what is justice? What is courage? I'd like to conclude this lecture by thinking a little bit about why Socrates was executed in 399. The official charge against him was that he was corrupting the young and that he had introduced new gods into the city of Athens. What I would like to do in order to speculate a little bit on what the reasons were for Socrates' execution is give you a bit of a historical, some historical background. I think that's necessary to understand what the world of Athens was like in 399 and why Socrates, in fact, was executed. So let me give you a thumbnail sketch of Athenian history in the 5th century. Be very brief. The 5th century, in a sense, starts around the year 490, runs to 480 in the Persian Wars. These were the famous wars against the invaders from the east, the Persian Empire. The Persian Empire was huge. The Persian Empire seemed to be able easily to dominate the Greeks. In fact, however, as the historian Herodotus reports, the Greeks managed to defeat the Persians in what was an almost miraculous victory. One reason the Greeks were able to win is that they were unified. As I said in an earlier lecture and implied even in this lecture, there was no Greece as we understand it. There was no nation of Greece in the 5th century. Greece was a conglomeration of small independent units, the famous city-state. During the Persian Wars, the very beginning of the 5th century, these Greek city-states worked together. And that's a primary reason why the Greeks finally defeated the Persians. In the immediate aftermath of the Persian Wars, Athens began to emerge as the dominant power. The Athenians would certainly have claimed that it was they, more than any other Greek city-state, who were responsible for the victory over the Persians. In the year 478, an alliance was formed among the Greek city-states, a defensive alliance to protect themselves against the Persians. This was known as the Delian League. It soon became apparent, however, that the Delian League was going to be dominated by Athens. And indeed, the Athenians dominated it to an extraordinary extent. Without going into any details of Athenian history, it's very apparent that the Athenians were expansionistic. They were going to use the resources of the Delian League in order to dominate all of Greece. This policy of expansionism really took hold under the leadership of Pericles, who ruled Athens from 450 to 429. I remind you that Athens was a democracy indeed, so no single man could ever rule it. However, Pericles was far and away the dominant figure in Athenian politics during these years. He had a very specific strategy of expansion. He was enormously ambitious. Most of all, he wished to conquer the great rival of Athens, and that was Sparta. Sparta and Athens, two different city-states, had been allied against the Persians. Beginning with Pericles, that alliance began to unwind. And in fact, there was a tremendous war between Athens and Sparta, the Peloponnesian War, which began in 431 and lasted almost 30 years. It's extraordinary to think of a war lasting that long. Pericles was a great leader during that time. The Parthenon was built. There were extraordinary developments in the theater, in art, in history, in philosophy. Nonetheless, we have to look at this period very objectively and say Pericles really did lead Athens into what ultimately became a disaster, because Athens lost the Peloponnesian War. In the year 404, at the very end of the Peloponnesian War, Athens was in chaos, so much so that the democracy, which had ruled in Athens for over 100 years, and of which the Athenians were so proud, was overthrown. A tyranny emerged. Today we would describe this as a right-wing coup. A group known as the 30 Tyrants took over the Athenian democracy, toppled it. There was very quickly a counter-revolt, and the 30 Tyrants were defeated. The democracy was restored in 403, very shortly thereafter. Recall that Socrates was executed in 399. In other words, at the very end of the 5th century, from the years 404 to 399, Athens was in terrible chaos. I think if we keep this historical context somewhat in mind, the execution of Socrates might become a bit more plausible. Socrates was well known to have associated with figures who later became some of the 30 tyrants. Some of the names include Critias and Charmides. Another notorious figure in this period was someone named Alcibiades. All of them had at one point or another associated with Socrates. In other words, in 399, the Athenians may have looked at Socrates and lumped him together with the 30 tyrants, and that may indeed have been a reason why he was executed. There's no way of knowing for sure what the reasons were. What I've just given you is nothing but one set of speculations. And I'd like to close this lecture with what I think is, in fact, a more interesting speculation. Certainly the political events of 399 were instrumental in the execution of Socrates, but perhaps we should look at this whole episode more philosophically. Socrates was a most annoying figure. To put it even more dramatically, perhaps the Athenians perceived Socrates as a genuine subversive. Philosophy was itself perceived in 399 as a threat to the stability of Athenian society. After all, reflect on these questions that I've been associating with Socrates. If I were to accost you in the streets, as Socrates seemingly accosted some of the Athenians, and ask you, what is justice? And if I pursued this question with the kind of intensity that Socrates seemed to have pursued his questions, what I would be doing is shaking to the foundation your view of the world. If I actually persuade you that the question, what is justice, is not so easily answered, you might well be left with the response, maybe I don't know what justice is. Well, if I don't know what justice is, maybe my city, the city of Athens, isn't really such a just and wonderful place. In other words, philosophy itself, as practiced by Socrates, may have been perceived by the Athenians as an intrinsically subversive activity. This is often very hard for us to understand in the year 2001. After all, philosophy is a very well-respected discipline in universities. Philosophers are professors. They hardly seem to be subversives. But perhaps the best reason to think about the execution of Socrates is precisely in order to consider the question, what is philosophy and is it in fact a subversive activity? What I will discuss in the next lecture is Plato himself, and I will explain as best I can how Plato took up the legacy of Socrates.